Good evening, everyone, and welcome to An Evening with Radio 4, where we'll be playing a variety of games lovingly stolen from Radio 4 panel shows. I'm your host, Ollie Jones, and I'm joined by four of Comedy Society's... Well, four people from Comedy Society. Marcus Crabb, Lewis Crook, Samuel Bowell, and Sasha White. Our first game of the evening is Dilemma, in which I will impale the panellists on the horns of dilemmas and then sort of give them a prod. Lewis, you enter your favourite type of restaurant.
But not when you've been in before. The owner recognises you. You saved my life, they exclaim, and offer you a free meal. You didn't save their life. Do you take the free meal?
Is the owner of the restaurant dead?
No, you saved their life.
Oh, wait, so he's mistaken me for someone who did save his life
yes.
in the situation.
Yes. Yeah,
okay, well, I am a student, and therefore my budget runs to about 60p a week. So I would take a free meal from this chap. Like, he is going to get the good feeling of giving out a free meal to someone who saved his life. I'm going to get the good feeling of a free meal. Everyone's a winner. Until the person who actually saved his life turns up and he thinks he's taking the piss for coming back for a second free meal.
But also, what if halfway through the meal he realises that you're not the person that saved his life? What if he looks at you and your mannerisms, the way you eat like a pig, he's like, this isn't him.
Well, he's not going to reach like, down my throat my and pull it out again.
It's a fair point. It's difficult to retract a free meal.
Yeah.
Lewis.
Well, no, it's not difficult. If you own the restaurant, it's not difficult to retract a free meal.
Yeah, just you give just give me a bill.
Lewis, what's your favourite type of restaurant? That's the big...
I think probably a classic Italian restaurant.
I'd do it for a Thai. I wouldn't do it for an Italian.
It could be that you have a secret twin and you and he have this thing going on where one of you endangers someone's lives and then saves it and then the other just goes, although it's a bit... I mean, it doesn't really work most of the time. Someone isn't really getting a good deal out of that.
I am going to have to give my... evil twin a call and check if that's happening.
Surely he's the good twin. You're the one that's getting the free meal without doing any life-saving whatsoever.
What do you reckon, Samuel?
Well, I think when it comes to accepting gifts from strangers, there's a tiered system here. If it were a fairly negligible item, like, I don't know, a biscuit, a free drink, or perhaps a free drink. But this is up another level, isn't it? This is a free meal.
But surely it's the same thing in principle.
No.
I think your example of a biscuit is a good one, though, because in a packet of biscuits, let's say you have 20, and we're talking bourbons here, it's 1/20th of your bourbons to give out a free bourbon. That restaurant owner's probably going to sell, what, 50 meals that day?
That's 19 bourbons.
Nowhere have we ever said that it's a popular Italian restaurant.
Okay, so you're saying that I'm his only customer
yes.
that day. The chance of feeding his family depends on
yes.
me paying for this meal.
Yeah.
I think he's dug his own grave there. I'm sticking with it. I'm taking the free meal.
Any disagreements? Any more quibbles?
I want to know how far you'll take the... Like, would you go for a three-course meal? Ooh. Would you just have a main course? Would you have some nibbles in a main course?
What if he introduced you to his daughter?
Yeah.
I'm not going to take his daughter as well. Three courses, perhaps I would start to pale at the thought. But... good, you know, sort of £15 mark. That was what I think would be reasonable for a life-saving incident.
That you didn't do!
I know I didn't do it, but again, it's a purely theoretical one for whether I did or didn't do it. The point is, he thinks I did.
Here's a tangential moral question. If you receive a free meal at a restaurant, do you still leave a tip?
Oh!
Well, 10% of nothing is nothing. I don't know, I probably would feel I should, but then at the same time it would be very strange to be like, thank you for the free meal, here's £2.
Is it that weird? I mean, you could just leave a bigger tip that's kind
well,
of
well,
like paid
for
the meal.
I was going to say, to cover the cost of the meal. So, we're going to stay with Sasha and move on to your dilemma.
Yep, hit me.
a lottery ticket falls out of your friend's bag as they get off the bus without them noticing. You pick it up and put it in your pocket, with every intention of returning it to them later. That evening, you're watching the lottery, and that ticket wins. Do you give it back to your friend?
How close am I to this friend?
Well, you're on the bus together, so...
Oh, God, it must be a lifelong friendship.
Things are pretty
serious. What if I just came across as really benevolent and was like, wow, friend, I've won the lottery. However, I will split it with you because you're my good bus-going friend.
Mm. How much?
Yeah, what's the jackpot?
Because like, the first time I entered the lottery as literally a six-year-old,
is that
I won...
Legal?
Are you okay, Marcus? Is there a gambling problem we should know about?
Yes. I won £5 whole.
Oh, that is like
That's a
million.
That's a lot for a six-year-old.
It is. Yeah, and then I didn't win the next week, and I cried for a whole week. Is it £5 or is it 100 million?
Let's go for a nice figure in between, which is about a million. Why not?
In between is 50 million.
We're going for a million.
Okay. I'd pay for their bus.
Yeah.
Next time.
I'd pay for the bus.
Tiga bus.
No, I'd pay for their next bus. I'd get them a bus
get
pass.
Get them a bus pass.
Yeah.
66 bus pass.
Get them a new
lottery
ticket.
Get them a bag with a zipper on it. Next time they buy a lottery ticket.
I feel like we should be more concerned about the sort of moral quandary of lying to your friend about a substantial amount of money.
I think there's a more significant complication here in that this is someone whom you regularly commute with. Is any amount of money worth having to hear them tell the anecdote about that one time they lost the winning lottery ticket every morning for the rest of your professional life?
Yeah, but I could just buy a car and then never get the
So what you're saying is you trade a friend for a lottery win.
Yeah.
Lewis, what do you reckon?
Well, this may come as a shock from the person who would take a meal from a poor Italian man. But I actually think the guilt of having £1 million but knowing you'd taken it from your friend, and as you saw their life get worse and worse, as they turned to drink because they lost their ticket, £1 million would turn to ashes in your mouth.
No, like, yeah. I deal with million the guilt pounds? In my jacuzzi with my champagne. To me, that's a good place to deal with guilt, as opposed to being the good person, giving back the lottery ticket, and then just sitting around regretting it. Is my friend going to give me money if they win the lottery then?
Well, are they your friend?
Well, I mean, that's what I'm saying. Just because I get the bus with them doesn't mean that it's a lifelong friendship that I have to sacrifice a lottery ticket for. Basically, we've discovered that my morals are that I wouldn't take a free meal off someone. However, I would steal £1 million off my
best
friend.
Basically rob a million pounds.
Okay. It's a tiered system, isn't
it? It is a tiered system.
Well, we are talking about the lottery here. It's £1 million that they never had in the first place.
Mm.
It's not theft.
Is it, though?
It's just depriving them of potential earnings.
Is that not theft?
That's pre-theft.
Well, yeah, pre-theft, I think, is the legal term.
Preft. If you buy a lottery ticket, I don't know how many people buy the lottery ticket, then memorise the numbers.
Yeah, they're
so
not
if you lost
know.
The lottery ticket, you wouldn't just be watching the thing like, those were my numbers!
Yeah.
Don't you say your
Unless
own numbers?
Unless my friend
like, some
is
people,
a pensioner.
Some people buy the same numbers every week.
Mm. People who are idiots and live
that.
Alone.
Hey.
Then they don't need the £1 million anyway. So.
Surely they need it more than anyone.
No, disagree.
No. They've got a bus pass out
no
of it.
No one needs
it, right.
Yeah.
There is the third option, which nobody seems very keen on, where you split it in half and say £500,000 because it was your ticket, £500 for me because otherwise
no. Because then you look like worse than the
that's
person.
Do you reckon?
Yeah, because you just don't tell them that you've got £1 million. Just buy a car, never see that person again.
Yeah.
These are your friends.
Change your identity.
It specifically says friend.
Yeah, but there's a spectrum of friends, as there is a tiered system with regards to accepting things.
I have a lot of friends who like, I'm not going to invite them to my house. But I'd be sad if they died.
Yeah.
All right, Marcus, they're part of the elite group where they're allowed to your house and you'd be sad.
Oh.
Yeah.
£1 million can get you a lot of facial reconstruction surgery.
And a new identity. And a house in a different country.
I don't want facial reconstruction surgery.
Do you know?
Thank you very much.
Well, we're going to move swiftly on from that. So your solution is move to a country and start a new life?
Yes.
Yeah, but £1 million isn't actually going to get you that far. If you get a car and facial reconstruction and move to a different country, I'm not sure we're going to cover all that.
Yeah, but we get 50 million just because I can't do the maths.
I'm getting 50 million. You're not getting
anything. Can I have a bus pass? Can I have a biscuit?
I'll give you a free Italian meal.
Oh, I can't believe you guys. I thought better of you.
I'm giving it back to, like, balance out my taking the meal. That's my stance.
So is that balanced, is it? Paying £1 million for a meal is what you've just said.
It better be a good Italian.
Yeah, it depends how good that.
Well, it's not because it's empty.
It's not empty.
No, it is empty.
He said it was.
Well, at no point did you specify the quality of the meal.
We're going to have to go back.
Oh, yes.
There's unfinished business here, I think.
Oh, dear. I didn't realise it would play such a big part in the second one, where you'd be like, oh, yeah, that lottery ticket, I'd better pay for my meal with that. I can't believe this. I thought so much better of you. just as a panel. You're letting me down. I would just keep it straight away. Like, you know, I mean, like, they wouldn't have that million if you didn't pick it up. So, to my mind, like you said, it's things they don't have. It's it's preemptive winnings that I would then have.
Oh, I see. So you're saying that if you hadn't picked it up, then the bus weirdo would have picked it up.
No one would have. It would have died on the floor like a bus ticket.
Okay.
Should we do another one? Do we feel like another one?
Yeah.
I'm all moraled out. I've had enough moral quandaries.
Lewis's karma is balanced, he feels, after he's given the money back for his meal. Okay, so after all that, the person who occupies the moral high ground is Samuel for his tiered systems of,
there we are.
Of morals. On to the next game. It's The Unbelievable Truth. Or, as it might otherwise be known, BBC News highlights from 2016. Because the news was messed up and we're not actually the BBC. So, each of our panellists will deliver a short speech on a pre-prepared topic. A speech that will be full of lies, but also contain 5 real facts. The other panellists will score points if they buzz in and identify the truths, and will lose points if they mistake a lie for a truth. So, for example, if I was talking about peanut M&Ms and said they were nice, you'd buzz in and tell me that was a lie, because it's not. They're horrible. I hate them. Points deducted. Right. Marcus,
hello.
You're going to kick us off.
Oh, goodness.
You're going to tell us all about tissue paper. Whenever you're ready.
So, the meteoric rise of tissues is one of the greatest marvels of our time. If the World War I soldiers who first used them to stuff into their gas masks could see them now, they'd be delighted and probably humbled by seeing grown adults depositing their mucus on Minion-branded Kleenex.
I'm going to say the gas mask thing's true.
It is true, but it's like an arbitrary truth.
You can't put in truths that aren't the truths.
I think you said first. You specified first used. So, if the tissue paper has a long and storied history,
I don't
it does.
Think I don't know that it would have survived a century and a bit. I'm afraid I'm going to have to take a point off you there, Sasha, leaving you on -1 for some reason.
Technically, it was
reason.
True. Yeah, go ahead.
Tissue paper is made by heating paper pulp on a large steel cylinder known as a Yankee dryer. Also available is the rival Confederate dryer, which works by delegating jobs to legally enslaved African dryers. Interestingly, this is also where the company Yankee Candles gets its name, from heating wax on a Yankee dryer, which is a revolutionary method. Yankee Candles also...
I already regret that buzz press, because this isn't to do with tissues, but is that thing about Yankee Candles true?
I'm afraid it isn't true, Lewis.
No. Is the other thing true, being made by heating pulp on Yankee...
I mean, it is,
but you missed your chance.
No, but I waited to the end of the sentence.
Because you're on -1, I'll put you back to 0.
Yeah. Yes!
Marcus?
Sticking with Yankee Candles for a second, they also once tried to follow up their successful fresh linen scent with the week-old tissue fragrance, but poor sales meant it was discontinued in, ironically, less than a week. Tissue paper is not to be confused with crepe paper, which, instead of being made in a Yankee dryer, is heated on a hot metal circle and is then immediately served with lemon and sugar. Crepe paper. Slow burner. when not used for wiping snot or protecting against gas attacks, tissue has many other uses. Bob Clearmountain, a recording engineer, once used tissues to dampen the excessive treble from his speakers. Clearmountain also played bass on the Dead Boys' first album, Young, Loud and Snotty. In the Second World War, Filipino drag queens would actually lick coloured tissue paper and press it on their faces to make up for not having makeup. Such as...
I think that thing about drag queens is true.
I'm afraid it's not true, Lewis.
Well, Lewis, as I said earlier, it's not to be confused with crepe paper, which is what Filipino drag queens used in World War II. My dissertation is awful. Full of fun facts like that. A recent study found that 60% of tissues are used for blowing noses. It doesn't say whose noses, but it does say that the remaining 40% are solely bought by adolescent males, along with Lynx Africa. North Korea reportedly consumes the fewest tissues in the world, preferring a more traditional handkerchief, which is more reusable for the buckets of tears they're not allowed to cry in public.
I think North Korea uses the fewest tissues.
I don't think that's true, I'm afraid.
Lewis. Oh,
I just believe everything you say, Marcus.
I'm an actor.
You hesitated there. Do North Koreans on average prefer the linen to the tissue?
I did say that.
Exactly, and I think it's true.
Oh, I don't know.
Oh.
Given that it's a thing that Marcus has made up, I can't allow it.
Answer the question.
I mean, I also don't know.
Britain consumes 15% of the world's tissues, and China leads, consuming 40% of the world's tissues. Kleenex.
I think China certainly might consume 40% of the world's tissues.
It does indeed consume 40% of the world's tissues.
Oh. Ah, it's got in my...
Get hyped! Yeah!
Yeah, facts!
Yeah. That's what it was my about. East Asian tissue consumption. I got it the wrong way around.
Kleenex, which originates from Neenah, Wisconsin, the home of the manhole... I've already booked my tickets. is one of the world's most recognisable tissue brands. It's also available in man size for the clinically insecure, extra thick for the extra thick, and balsam, which is a made-up word and is used to excuse the fact that it is 10% more expensive than normal tissues. The name of the band, The White Stripes, comes in part from when the band members used to toilet paper each other's houses in college. And in the 1970s, a cult horror film was made, telling the tale of those Barbies that sit in loo rolls in crochet dresses, becoming possessed and murdering their owners. It was called Crinoline of Sin. Tissues aren't all fun and games. In 1995, Bill Grable of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, filed for divorce after his wife Linda repeatedly machine-washed pairs of his trousers without checking for a tissue in the pocket. Liberty handkerchiefs, known for their distinct floral designs and their ability to make my mother spend all of her money, recently attempted a floral disposable tissue, but sales were discontinued after a woman from Cheshire wrote something on Mum's Net. That's tissues for you.
That is the end of Marcus's lecture.
Well, you're welcome.
Marcus actually managed to slip three truths past the rest of the panel.
Did I?
You did indeed.
Okay.
The recording engineer, Bob Clearmountain, did once use it to tame the overbright treble from his speakers.
And also, sneaky fact... He did actually play bass on Young, Loud and Snotty, which is magical.
The first headquarters of Kleenex was in the town of Neenah, Wisconsin.
It is the home of the manhole. They make manholes.
So many facts. 60% of tissues are used for blowing noses. The other 40% I will leave for your speculation. So Marcus ends that with 3 points. And next up, we have Sasha telling us about the classic Florida dessert, key lime pie.
I think we can all agree that key lime pie is a delightful cloud of dessert heaven.
That's a lie. Can we all agree that key lime pie is a delightful cloud of dessert heaven?
I don't know if you understand.
All right. Okay, Marcus, we'll throw it to the audience. Raise your hand if it is a cloud of whatever you said.
Well, Hannah agrees with me.
That is three people that have agreed. We have not all agreed.
So you lose a point.
I identified the lie.
You don't identify the lie. I'm so
confused.
Marcus, you're looking for truths. It's the unbelievable
truth.
Can I
have a point, please?
No. However, given that the audience seemed to share your view that it wasn't a cloud of whatever, I'm not going to take a point on.
I'm on -3 for playing the game. Marcus has entirely misunderstood the concept.
But we've
and you're not
going to
take
fun.
A point from him.
No, I'm not going to. Sasha, do continue.
Outrageous.
Anyway, after our agreement that key lime pie is a delightful cloud of dessert heaven, its key ingredients are limes and, of course, keys.
It's a lie. No, okay.
Giving it its famous citrus burst with a pleasing metallic undertone. This tangy surprise is so well-liked, America in 2005 voted it most loved dessert, placing it only slightly higher than cherry pie.
That seems plausible.
No, you're wrong. No.
Marcus is doing my job for me, but I'm afraid that is not a thing that's true.
I'm doing deduction in my head. That's how I'm working it through.
You could do deduction in your head.
That's a lie. I cannot.
You don't buzz for the lies. The reason for its success lies in the delicate lime flavouring known as Citrus X Aurantiafolia, named according to the Swingle system, a method of citrus taxonomy devised by Walter Tennyson Swingle, a figure also well known for his collection of erotic poetry written from the perspective of one of Henry VIII's wives.
I think this Swingle thing is... the Citrus X, I think, is true.
It is true. It is
true. I did the game right, guys!
Thank you.
It's almost as though that was a really scientific word and very difficult to smuggle past as something I made up.
It's Citrus X.
It's Citrus X Aurantiafolia. Anyway.
Adapted from a recipe used by sponge fishermen, the first key lime pie, as we know and love it today, was baked by a loofah salesman named Theodore Gloop, passing through the village on business. His quest to find the heavily guarded recipe proved difficult, as his numerous digging exhibitions to find the sea chest containing the recipe card seemed to yield nothing except enormous treasure troves of gold. Frustrated, he eventually popped into the local Waitrose, bought a couple of limes and some McVitie's, and knocked something up at home. And thank God he did. Now, we can all pop to the freezer section in our local and grab ourselves a delicious key lime pie.
That's true.
I'm not going to lie to you. That
you
is
are.
True.
That's the game.
But so was the thing that you said at the beginning, but it wasn't written down true.
You got me.
Can we move on? Is that all right?
Can I just clarify first? I'm getting confused. Key lime pie is quite different from lemon meringue pie. Is that correct?
Yes.
Key lime doesn't have any meringue in it.
It's lime.
Yeah.
And keys. She said it at the beginning.
I was just thinking.
That's why I'm winning.
You can't freeze meringue.
It may or may not contain meringue.
That's true.
I don't. It's almost as though Marcus doesn't care about key lime pie, and that's really hurtful to me.
That's a lie.
Please, Marcus.
You don't buzz the lies.
Sasha, please.
The wondrous invention of the frozen variant on the dessert, created by a Flora employee, Fern Butters. Thankfully, her invention precipitously preempted the Great Florida Lime Drought of 1926, in which a hurricane wiped out the state's entire lime crop, as well as, bizarrely, its youth culture. A loss it...
I think a hurricane wiped out Florida's entire lime crop.
It did indeed.
Yes!
He's storming back up to -3.
As well as, bizarrely, its youth culture, a loss it has never recovered from. This was not an issue for the vast pensioner population who stocked up their vitamin C in Barocca bunkers before the disaster. Thankfully, limes contain less vitamin C than lemons anyway. No one really gave a shit in the end.
Do limes contain less vitamin C than lemons?
They do indeed.
Because they're smaller.
I would like to argue...
It's lucky we don't give points for a reasoning.
Barocca is both of those things, but contains more vitamin C.
Thank you for that, Sasha. You managed to smuggle two truths past the rest of the panel.
What was it?
I'm going to tell you, Marcus. I will never tell you. The recipe was adapted from one used by a local sponge fisherman, and the frozen variant was created by someone called Fern Butters.
No. Oh.
Yes, it was.
Can she lose a point?
Sorry, audience. You're down to -1.
I'm very intrigued by this sponge fisherman concept.
Have you ever had a sea sponge? Not like to eat, but like...
I was going to say, they've not done it on the bake-off yet.
As a loofah?
Yeah.
Yes. That's why I said loofah salesman.
Well, we'll move on to the comeback. So Lewis will talk about his favourite author in the whole wide world, apparently, Jane Austen.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of good fortune must be an absolute legend.
Well, I don't wish to boast.
I'm the same, but I'm not a legend.
We'll just move on. Okay. For the best.
Those were the words written by Jane Austen to open her novel Pride and Prejudice. And they were carved onto her grave...
They are the words that open Pride and Prejudice.
No, because it doesn't say
the first
absolute
two,
legend.
Or at least the first two words of Pride and Prejudice.
Oh, yes, of course, absolute legend. That doesn't appear at all.
Austen was surprisingly light on absolute legend.
Austen coined that particular phrase. Yeah. But it was in Sense and Sensibility. My mistake. Yeah.
I'm afraid I'm going to take a point off for you there, Sam. So yeah, Lewis, do continue.
Okay. To open her novel Pride and Prejudice, and they were carved onto her gravestone when she finally passed away, gored to death in Pamplona during the famous running of the bulls. But what else do we know about the woman behind the books? Jane Austen started every day with a large glass of cool, refreshing OJ because she was petrified of getting scurvy. Her parents tried to discourage her from a career in writing, pushing her towards blacksmithing.
No. Did Jane Austen have a phobia of scurvy?
Who doesn't have a phobia of scurvy?
An irrational, obsessive phobia.
Not that we know about, I'm afraid. So, yeah, I'm afraid I'm gonna whip another point off there. I've gone mad with power. Lewis, do continue.
So, pushing her towards blacksmithing, to which Austin, who was 6'5" and weighed 18 stone in her prime, seemed more physically suited. Because of her mighty frame, she never learnt to be a confident swimmer and insisted on being accompanied by her teacher wherever she had to take a dip.
I'm going to say that that's true.
I buzzed first.
No, you did not. Mine lit up.
Yeah, that is a good point. Although you're going to wish you hadn't claimed it.
It was definitely Marcus, 110%.
No, it's actually not supposed to highlight the lies. That's the game.
It's good to see Marcus has caught up. Lewis, do continue.
Yeah, whenever she had to take a dip, because Miss Latonelle had a leg made of cork and a flair for the dramatic, making her an excellent flotation device.
Did Jane Austen's teacher possess a cork leg?
She did indeed. And a passion for theatre. Do continue, Lewis.
Jane Austen started every day with a large glass of brandy, insisting that it made her breakfast taste nicer.
Sure, why not?
Did she go for brandy with OJ, or was it...
It was she had both.
Right, okay.
I'm afraid neither of them are true.
So. Well, Sasha's lit up first.
I did not!
I'm going to take it off you there, Marcus.
Okay, I'm winning anyway.
She was notoriously picky with what kind of pens she used.
That sounds true.
It's not true.
What the... Why books are so bad.
I've played you all. insisting that her fountain pen was always kept topped up with the ink of a Humboldt squid. On a trip to Germany, she befriended one Mr. Biro, who gifted her an early prototype of his new invention, the Biro.
I'm going to say that's true.
Sasha, please.
Damn it!
Soon after the publication of Sense and Sensibility, Austin discovered the secret of time travel. and had a number of zany adventures throughout space and time. She helped Churchill win World War II, convinced Sir Christopher Wren to take up architecture, and killed the members of Colin Firth's family, one by one, until he agreed to play Mr. Darcy.
Did she convince a young Christopher Wren to take up architecture?
I'm afraid not, Samuel.
He was 100 years before her.
Oh, so. There we are.
I mean, you did say time travel.
Jane Austen started every day with a big glass of Gold Standard peanut butter flavour whey protein shake. Because she was making mad gains. Her relentless appetite for carbs became a problem in the great flour shortage of 1808, at the height of the Napoleonic Wars, when she would endlessly research the most efficient way to bulk. She wrote to her sister in June saying, "You know how interesting the purchase of a sponge cake is to me." And indeed, despite its airy texture, sponge cake was a favourite among heavy manual labourers in the early 19th century.
Did she write to her sister saying about sponge cake?
She did write to her sister about sponge cake. I don't know how you can find the purchase of a sponge cake particularly interesting, but she was nuts, so we move on.
In the Victorian age, rival groups favouring different authors were set up. Austin's were called Janeites, Charles Dickens's were called Charlie's Angels, and the readers of the Iliad and the Odyssey were called homosexuals. In 1910, a sequel to Pride and Prejudice was discovered in a house in Devon. It was entitled Racial Pride and Prejudice and saw Elizabeth Bennet become a skinhead.
I think someone did discover a sequel to Pride and Prejudice. No.
No. Sorry, Samuel.
It is believed to have been written about the time that she was juggling the three men in her life. She encouraged Jackson Wig Bithers to travel ahead of her to South America on the promise that she would join him once he made his fortune. He died there of dengue fever.
That sounds like the thing that she'd do. Yeah. Hashtag waste his time. 18, 17. That's what I do.
And it's not a snappy hashtag, and it's not true.
Claude Chig Livers only found out his proposal had been refused when he saw an article she wrote in the Times calling him the ugliest man to set foot in Bath that year. She actually accepted Harris Big Withers' proposal, but just changed her mind the next day because she wanted the hat trick. He was in no position to disagree, as, unlike Jane Austen, he was not a four-time WWE Super Slam champion.
It's true that he was not a WWE Super Slam champion.
I mean, neither was Jane Austen.
No, but he said it. He was not.
I mean, you're not.
I'm still winning.
You're not wrong, Marcus, but I'm not.
So give me
a
point
now.
Just a little one.
And that is the end of Lewis's lecture. Lewis has done remarkably well there. He's back to zero. He's smuggled three truths past our panel. Her fans were known as Janeites. She did accept a marriage proposal from Harris Big Wither, but changed her mind the next day. And according to Winston Churchill, Austin did help him win World War II.